You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, Community Supported Radio. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And tonight I have as my co-host Irving Kirsch. This is new for him. And then we've also got our special guest, Barry Shamish. And am I pronouncing your name, Barry, correctly?
Yeah, Chamish, it'll do.
Chamish, okay, because I've heard numerous people pronounce it differently, and I thought I'd better hear it from you first. And let me let you go ahead and explain a little bit about yourself before we get started here, and then we'll let you go from there and tell us about some of the information on that you're working with in your journalistic expertise.
Yeah, well, it confuses people. That there is a kind of protest from proud Israelis and pretty patriotic Israelis against the Israeli rulers. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with Arabs. It has a lot to do with the treatment of Jews. And what I'm going to bring up tonight is a fact that people don't understand, that there's the equivalent of a civil war going on in Israel. Fortunately, it hasn't erupted into bloodshed, at least not massive bloodshed. But the communities fighting the government is probably, well, the communities are probably more than half of Israel. If you use the phony elections as a guide, where in the last elections, 67% of the Jews voted right-wing and religious, and they threw out the left really completely.
Okay, Barry, before we get any further on this, though, why don't we go ahead and it's been a couple of years since I've had you on my program, and get the audience acquainted with a little bit with your background first, and then let's go ahead and go back to what you were talking about.
My background, I'm very well known in Israel. I had one book that made number one in the country, and it was called Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin? And it's about the truth of the Rabin assassination, that they're holding a patsy in prison, and he was killed in an internal coup led by the now president, Shimon Peres. He gave the order to kill. He plotted the assassination. How it was done, I won't go into right now. I've got a book. You can get it on the internet at a place called lulu.com, lulu.com, and you can get Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin. That made my name in Israel, and I had expected that I had gathered so much proof, no speculation. I gathered evidence from the hospital, from the police, from the Secret Services, from eyewitnesses. It was a very, very convincing book. And every poll in the last 7 or 8 years have shown that a majority of religious Israelis and a third of secular just outright accept my book's the truth, and the government's version is a lie.
Okay, Matt, how do we get a hold of you so that people can purchase this book and get a little bit of understanding of everything else that you're doing? Give them your website.
All right, I'll give it, but the timing isn't right. I'm giving a website way before people even understand what I do. Go easy of the timing. It's kind of inappropriate.
Okay.
You get the books at something called lulu.com, www.lulu.com. There's a search box. Type in my name, and that's C H A M ISH, and you'll get the books. But let's not upset the apple cart here. We haven't begun yet.
Okay.
In fact, I think it's time we began, and the introduction, as far as I'm concerned, is over.
Okay.
Okay, I'll talk about the contemporary issues, and later on I'll tell you how to get a hold of me. You either like me or you don't, but we're far from that point now. Now, let me tell you what's going on in Israel at this moment, and that is that President Obama has, within 2 weeks, this will be a fact. You have a prediction for me, but I've got the facts from media that I actually trust. There are journalists I actually trust. Obama will issue a letter guaranteeing United States support for a plan to force Israel to give up the West Bank and East Jerusalem to the Palestinians within 2 years. And, by the way, once you divide Jerusalem, it becomes Belfast or Beirut. It just becomes a nightmare. Jerusalem was divided pre-67, and you couldn't walk down a street without real risk of being shot by snipers. So they want to bring back the good old days to Israel. And how they're doing it is that Egypt is going to be the good broker. This is the way the Americans view Egypt, that Egypt will be the broker, the key negotiator with Israel in this Obama plan. Now, what you have to understand is that Israel's national security advisor, his name is Uzi Arad, he is now negotiating with the Egyptians on the division of Israel and the division of their capital. Now, keep something in mind. The Israeli people did not elect a government to divide Jerusalem and divide their country up. They spoke at the elections and were ignored. The religious and right-wing parties are sitting on the sidelines doing nothing. And Labor Zionism, of which I'll talk about more, the Labor Party is in the government, and fewer than 8% of Israelis voted for them. So it doesn't really matter who you elect. It has no bearing whatsoever on what's going to happen to the country. But I want to tell you a little about you can call it the secret brokers of Israel, the secret rulers. And this is very, very serious stuff. And there's a little think tank in Manhattan called the Council on Foreign Relations. It's got 4,000 members, maybe 3,000 are window dressing, but the key members really determine policy, not just in Israel, but they determine policy worldwide. But again, if you don't know anything about it, I'm not going to clue you in on that. You'll have to look it up yourself. All I can say is that in 4,000 members, number one, Netanyahu, I've got the book from 1988, the CFR Annual Guide. Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations in 1988, an actual member. Uzi Arad is a very interesting story, how I discovered his ties. I was in Australia. My hostess was Ilana Levy, and she pulled out the bio of Uzi Arad. I won't tell you where he was working then, but he was in the defense and anti-terror community of Israel. And she said she saw him speak. He hands out the bio, and on the bio he proudly announces that he once was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Ilana went up to him and said, "You were an actual CFR member?" And he caught on that she didn't like this, and he backtracked. But the fact remains that while the Israeli people elected a government that would supposedly keep Israel together, the actual government was chosen ultimately by the Americans, or at least the Council on Foreign Relations, well, to destroy Israel ultimately. No matter how you look at it, and no matter how many justifications for Israel's security, they are going to chop Israel up and make it indefensible. Now, this CFR business goes back a long, long time, at least since Henry Kissinger almost cost Israel the Yom Kippur War in 73. But it's a long and awful story, and I've been writing it through innumerable books. The Israeli government, it doesn't matter if you vote right, it doesn't matter if you vote left, you get the CFR in charge. Now, there is one other ruler, a true ruler of Israel, and that is Europe, ultimately the Vatican. And again, I don't want to get so conspiratorial that I lose people who say it's not true. It is true. The other side of the equation is Shimon Peres and his gang, who are thoroughly controlled by the Vatican. And by the way, this is a subject that 2 hours doesn't begin to tell this story, and I think I will try and tell it later. But the key issue is that Netanyahu is right now negotiating the division of Jerusalem while telling the Israeli people, and this is a quote from Netanyahu, that he will never cede control of United Jerusalem. That quote came out 3 days ago. He will never cede control of United Jerusalem. The only problem is, again, I wrote this, and if you've actually been reading what I send to you, you know this, that there are 700 new housing units in Jerusalem for Jews. That's it. 700 this entire year, about 2,500 people in a city of 800,000. It doesn't begin to house the people who need housing. Nonetheless, I said that number 700 came directly from the United States, and, well, that's what came out. It's all over the Israeli media right now, that Netanyahu went to Obama and he said, I'm under considerable cabinet pressure. I have to give in a little bit. And he traded a condemnation of Israel building homes for Jews in Jerusalem for a very mild condemnation by Obama. This was the deal for the 700 apartments that Israel built for Jews this year. It was with the permission of Obama. Netanyahu will cede control of United Jerusalem, and it's going to happen probably in the next 2 to 3 weeks. You're going to see an announcement that peace is on the way. Israel is going to divide itself in half, divide its capital in half, and peace is on its way. You're going to have snipers and terrorists along the walls of Jerusalem and the borders of Israel. It's really going to be the end of Israel. It's going to be indefensible. That's subject number one.
Okay, now, Barry, are you saying then, is this going to be something that's officially done, or is it being staged?
Yes, okay, all right. From the Obama administration.
Okay, well, I was kind of getting the impression that you were making it sound like it was staged, but you're saying
it's staged. What does that mean, staged? It's going to be announced.
Because a lot of times they will say they're going to have peace talks and they're going to do all these things, and then it doesn't really come about. That's why I say that.
Well, I don't know who announces that they're going to have peace talks, but you call them peace talks, but they've all been done. From the Oslo Accord, which will destroy Israel ultimately, is this accord signed in Oslo in 19... Well, it was signed in Washington, but was reached in Oslo in 1993. It was done. Well, you think any Israeli want to bring the PLO from Tunis and put them in their backyard? It's always been done. Now, the Arabs won't sign an actual peace with Israel. Why should they? They see the cards on the table. They see the pressure on Israel, And they know that in the end, Israel will acquiesce and die. So they don't actually sign anything that's going to bring true peace. But the Israelis have signed away their country.
What is the benefit for the destruction of Israel?
For who? For the people of Israel, nothing, obviously. For the Jews, nothing, obviously. But you're talking about a world government that you don't see. They're lingering in the shadows, and they've decided that Israel's really just got to go. And now I can go through the motions. It's a long, long story of how Israel was formed, by the way, with the connivance of these shadow rulers, and how Israel did not become the state that they wanted it to become, and how Israel became religious. Oh, boy. I'm going to talk about another subject that will possibly put things in order, but the last thing the original founders of Israel wanted was a revival of the Jewish religion in Israel. That's not why Israel was founded.
The early Zionists you're referring to, or the post-war?
I've got a problem. I can't hear you.
Are you referring to the early Zionist movement or the post-war?
Well, they were working. Look, again, the early Zionists had an awful lot more than help. Help is the wrong thing to say. Look, the British, all right, I'm going to do this with you. Why not? I had sort of a plan, but I'm going to do this with you.
Now, the reason I ask is my curiosity goes to what is the motivation, again, the benefit, obviously, to the Jewish people in Israel and worldwide, there is no benefit. But what is the benefit to the destruction of Israel? Does it just take this annoying gnat off the table, or what?
All right. First of all, I want you to know that it's very hard to hear you.
Oh, I apologize.
But again, you're talking benefit, and you don't have the background, so it doesn't make sense. And I'm going to try and fill in the background now, and just bear with me. If you don't understand this, you don't understand where Israel came from. Now, first of all, just know there were two breeds of Zionism. There wasn't a Zionist movement. There were actually three main primary movements in Zionism. One was labor Zionism. That was the founders. That was David Ben-Gurion and Chaim Weizmann and Golda Meir, and they were all dreck. These were murderers. Then there was the good, and I'll go into that shortly. It might be a little early to even announce that, but there was a good Zionism. It was called the Revisionist Zionists or the Herut Zionists, who were actual patriots and viewed all Jews as worthy of being saved. And that's a Zionism that I still belong to, even though it's dead. And supposedly Netanyahu is the representative, but it's dead. And then there's religious Zionism, which, well, they have now joined forces more or less with revisionist Zionists against labor Zionism. But the point is, labor Zionism runs Israel. They run the media, they run the universities, they run the police, they run the courts. Whatever counts in Israel is being run by this minority. And they really could not care less if Israel comes or goes, just so long as they get their money out in time. Now, I'm going to go all the way back to the year 1896. I'll go 1898 is the year that Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, met Wilhelm of Germany, in Jerusalem. Now, just understand, I believe it was 1896. Now, it doesn't matter. Forget the dates now. It was 1896 that Wilhelm of Germany, the strongest nation in continental Europe, went to Jerusalem. Now, this is not a simple trip. Nobody went to Jerusalem in 1896. First of all, getting there was a nightmare. After you landed at Jaffa, you were attacked by bandits. You had to get protection. You got to the city. There were no hotels. If you didn't have a church to stay in, you actually didn't have shelter. Nobody went there, let alone the leader of the biggest nation in continental Europe. But lo and behold, on November 2nd of 1896, Theodor Herzl met Wilhelm of Germany in Jerusalem. Herzl went there. Now, why on earth would the two really... this was a meeting that was of tremendous historical import. Why would Herzl meet Wilhelm in Jerusalem when nobody in their right mind went to Jerusalem there back then? Now, Herzl had only one reason. He wanted a state, and he thought that Germany would attack Turkey and give the Jews a state, or else he wouldn't have gone to Jerusalem. Now, if you go on the Internet and you write Herzl, Wilhelm, Jerusalem, and look at the meeting, there's almost nothing written about it. But what we do know, because everybody says the same quote, was that Herzl was rebuffed. And again, rebuff when your father of Zionism means that you didn't get a stake. But Germany made an alliance with Turkey, and it got itself all kinds of churches. Three major churches, but the big one was on Mount Zion. This is the Abbey of the Dormition. To this day, it overlooks all of Jerusalem. It's the most obvious feature. It was given to Germany. The Turks essentially gave the Catholic Church the best spot in the city for a church. And an alliance was created, and Germany and Turkey were never going to give the Jews a state. Never, never, never. Now, Herzl went back to England. And without diving into why the British wanted the Jews to go back to go to Israel, in short, there was something called the British-Israelite Alliance. The top of the British ruling elite, well, Benjamin Disraeli on down, the prime minister, every which way, the British thought they were Jews. This is what the biggest fad of Victorian England amongst the elite was, that England was actually founded by the tribe of Dan, and London is from the tribe of Dan, and this river and that river. England wanted the Jews back in Israel. That's where Zionism was founded, in essence. And I'm skipping, boy, am I skipping a lot. But when Herzl came back from being rebuffed, he no longer believed that the Jews could get a home in Israel. He told the British that. He said it's hopeless. In order to get Israel, Eretz Israel, Palestine, whatever name you gave the place, into Jewish hands, you'd have to have a war against the biggest power in Asia, the Turks, the biggest power in continental Europe, the Germans. It wasn't worth it. I don't want a state. That's it. Herzl backed out of the Zionist movement. And, look, Herzl died very shortly afterwards at age 44. Now, when I was growing up, I heard the baloney that he worked so hard that his heart just stopped. Right? Even in 1905, when you're 44 years old, your heart didn't just stop because you worked so hard. He went into a Paris sanatorium for reasons, well, try and find the reasons, all been wiped out of history. But he was there for several weeks, and he didn't have a heart attack, and he was murdered. I have no way of telling you who did the murder. I know the motive, though. Herzl didn't believe that he could get a state in Palestine, and asked the British for a state in Africa, in the region of Uganda, as the only hope for Zionism. Then the muckraking, the big stuff started. there was a war, England versus Turkey and Germany, where the English finally in 1917 captured Jerusalem, taking a million troops out of the trenches of Europe and sending them to the Middle East and redrawing the map of the Middle East. Whatever, they got Jerusalem back. Allenby walks in 1917, and then suddenly there's a letter from Sir Arthur Balfour to Nathan Rothschild. It's called the Balfour Declaration, looking with pleasure at the creation of a Jewish home in Palestine. This is what Herzl feared the most. Millions died in a stupid war. Many, many thousands died in the Middle East so the British could get their land. And they believed it, their holy land. They were working with the Zionists, well, what is now known as the Zionist movement. I don't want to use that because simply the labor Zionists didn't represent the Jews anywhere. But nonetheless, they got to Israel with British permission now and started setting up all kinds of institutions. But the big one, still on King George Street in Jerusalem, was the Jewish Agency. That was the shadow government of Israel and ultimately the shadow government of the Jews of the world. When, after the Holocaust, when there were no more Jews left in Europe practically, the Jewish Agency represented Zionism. And something terrible happened, and believe me, I'm jumping. In 1933, the labor Zionists negotiated a treaty with the Nazis. It's called the Transfer Agreement. This was a god-awful, horrible treaty. In this treaty, the Nazis agreed to make life so miserable for German Jews that they would come to Palestine, where the Jewish Agency agreed that the Jews would be forced to use all their funds to buy German or Nazi goods, and worldwide there would be no rallies, no boycotts of Nazi Germany. This thing was actually signed, and the revisionist Zionists were disgusted that this thing existed. And in 1933, before the transfer agreement was signed, there was a conference in Prague, the World Zionist Conference, where they threatened to bring the whole thing down over the nerve of the Jewish Agency signing a deal with the Nazis. Now,
Barry, let me ask you one thing. Doesn't this
this hasn't gone to the end.
Okay.
What did you ask? At least take it to the end for a second.
Okay.
There was a murder in Tel Aviv in 1933 of Chaim Arlozorov. He was the negotiator of the transfer agreement between the Jewish Agency and the Nazis. At this Prague conference, it was announced that the revisionist Zionists, led by someone named Zev Jabotinsky, were found to be the murderers. They were thrown out of the Zionist movement. They didn't revive until 1948. After the Holocaust, the Zionists, only the labor Zionists, controlled the Zionist movement, and they were cutting a deal with the Nazis. Now, what my final point on this, in 1936, Chaim Weizmann spoke before the World Zionist Conference without the revisionist Zionists in attendance and said that 1936, I'm going to say, that in the upcoming Holocaust, maybe only 2 million Jews will survive, but they'll be strong and good for Israel. The rest will be relegated to the ash pit of history. And he was applauded for this. They were working with the Nazis. And I don't know how deep the Holocaust is, but I've got other examples to say that the labor Zionists were really in deep with the Nazis. All right, ask your questions, and then I'll go on.
Okay, what I'm wondering is if the labor movement that grew out of the teens in this country also had a tie-in with the Zionism, correct? And that they all tied in with somewhat with what was going on in Russia, correct?
That's called the Bund. Okay. And that was a worldwide... That was the Bund. That was a socialist labor movement that was all over the world. And wherever Jews were allowed, they tended to go to the leadership of that. Not all were Zionists.
Okay. All right, but that then tied in with Lenin and Trotsky and that.
Well, that was the Bund again.
Okay. All right.
This is irrelevant.
Okay.
I mean, there might be some relevance, but it's not. I don't know what it is.
Okay. That's
the Bund certainly worked in organizing Jews in Germany. Of that, there is no doubt. Look, in 1932, 250 Jewish organizations represented the Jews of Germany. In 1934, all were eliminated but one, and that was labor Zionism. Only labor Zionism survived. They represented all the Jews. They put them in camps and indoctrinated them in something I don't know how deeply I should go into this. It's called Sabbateanism, and maybe I'll hit it later. It's not the time now. But they prepared them for Israel. Many, many were former Buddhists. All right, the labor Zionists got their German Jews out of the Bund, but that was, again, labor Zionism was socialist Zionism, so it was only natural that you don't go into the synagogues to get your members, you go to the Bund to get your members. Nonetheless, in 1934 all the way to 1941, labor Zionism was the only organization in Germany that represented the Jews, and they got the Jews to Germany. From 1934 to 1939, 70,000 German Jews came to Palestine, and they just changed the nature of the whole country. Suddenly, Judaism had really no place in the new Israel. And we're talking about secularism and socialism to an extreme degree. They despise the religious. And keep in mind, there had been a religious Jewish community in Israel from time immemorial. They were the majority. The religious Jews were the majority population of Jerusalem, Sfat, Tiberias. They were just pushed out by these Zionists. And by the way, the ultra-Orthodox hatred of the Zionists continues to this day. But neither here nor there. The point of the matter is in 1939, as the war began, World War II began, Britain closed Israel to all but the tiniest amount of immigration from Europe. I think it was 5,000. They closed the doors of Europe to the Jews. The Jews were trapped behind an iron wall, and then the Holocaust began. There's a whole different side to this. The labor Zionists did not want a bunch of religious right-wing Jews from Poland and Russia ruining their experiment in starting a new kind of Judaism. It's called Sabbatean Judaism. I will hit that later. They were quite prepared to see them get wiped out so that Judaism would start again with German Jewish seed stock. Now, I don't know if you know, there is one book that's become a classic, but many, many other books, including my own, about Rudolf Kastner. The book that's become a classic is Ben Heck's Perfidy. Ben Heck was, if you don't know, was a major Hollywood writer. He actually rewrote Gone with the Wind. He wrote The Front Page. He was a very talented Hollywood writer. He covered the trial of Malkiel Greenwald, who was sued by the Israeli government for libel because he said that a major Israeli bureaucrat political by the name of Rudolf Kastner was working hand-in-hand with Adolf Eichmann to make sure that 800,000 Jews trapped in Hungary were murdered. Now, this and he wrote this, and he was like me. I relate to this guy. He died poor, and he never got the recognition he deserved, but he was proven right in a court of law that the Jewish agency were given ample opportunities to save the Jews of Europe. The Nazis, well, look, Eichmann knew in 1944 that the war was lost, and he didn't want any more guilt than he already had on his head. He offered the Jews the right to take every one of them to Palestine, all 800,000 of them. He wanted trucks. He wanted to take his loot out of Hungary and get the hell out of there. And he made the offer, not just to Kastner, he also made it to Rabbi Yoel Brandt, who also wrote about the incident, and Kastner turned Eichmann down. Kastner went from concentration camp to concentration camp, picking the Jews that he wants to save, family and fellow laborites. He saved, so-called saved, 3,500. They arrested anyone who tried to save all 800,000 of them, and off they went merrily, merrily away to the gas chambers. Now, there was a trial in Jerusalem in 1952 where Grunewald was supposedly going to go to jail for libeling Rudolf Kastner, but after all the witnesses showed up, it's a tremendous book, it's called Perfidy, you found out that Grunewald was right and the Jewish agency was working with Eichmann. Now, I want you to know that in Israel, the three main characters were all assassinated. Character number one, Rudolf Kastner, who knew a little too much about how the Jewish agency ordered him to save the right Jews and let the rest die. He was murdered in his hotel, in his hospital room by the Shabak, the Israeli Secret Service. I believe the year was 55. I wrote a book called Save Israel. I interviewed a hospital orderly who actually saw the murder and was told to shut up for many, many years. He phoned me up one day. I met him. I have pictures and witnesses. His name was Yossi Cohen. I lived in Tel Aviv. And there was a witness to the murder of Kastner. The next murdered person was someone named Wallenberg. Raoul Wallenberg was a Swedish diplomat who was trying to save the Jews of Hungary. He was the only decent person in this story, and he did save 1,500, perhaps, after the Russians took Hungary. He was never heard from again, and the Israelis and all the Jews are taught that the Russians killed Wallenberg. What for? What do the Russians have to worry about Raoul Wallenberg for? The only group that had to worry were the labor Zionists and the Zionists of the Jewish agency during the war, when he knew too much that they were selling the Jews down the creek. He died, he disappeared, never seen again. And then finally, Eichmann was the only Holocaust, and again, the only Holocaust trial. The only one in Israel, forget the Maniac, that was cut short. The only trial where there was a potential to try tens of thousands of butchers. Israel didn't try even one. The only one was Adolf Eichmann, because he knew too much about the Jewish agency and the neglect, deliberate neglect that led to the rubbing out of 800,000 Jews in Hungary. He was brought to Israel, put into a soundproof booth, and supposedly assassinated, executed. I don't even know about that. I'll tell you this. There was so much bad stuff going on. Why didn't Israel, well, please, there were 100,000 survivors of the Nazis, that's all. not the 2 million that Weizmann predicted, but they had plenty of eyewitness reports to bring plenty of people to trial. Only Eichmann went to trial in Israel for the Holocaust. That's it, because he knew that the Jewish agency, because he was working, once again, he was working with Rudolf Kastner and knew that the Jewish agency was turning down all his offers to not kill the Jews. Israel was never, ever, ever built to be a shelter for the Jews. Never. It was built to be the capital of a new Judaism that rejected the Torah, that rejected the Talmud, and I'll talk about Sabbateanism very, very shortly, accepted a perverse view of Judaism with a new Messiah named Shabtai Tzvi and a second Messiah named Yaakov Levi. They built a state around phony, baloney messiahs and let all the religious Jews of Europe get slaughtered. And that is what, well, those Jews who found out a little too much are protesting the establishment, the ruling establishment, the labor establishment of Israel, because these people are butchers. And forget Arabs. I'm talking about butchers of Jews. They don't see themselves as Jews. They see themselves as Sabbateans. It's something a little different. I'm not sure you followed that.
Oh, yes. No, I followed it quite well.
Likewise.
All right. Now, that is the background. Now, would you like to go to the foreground of what's happening today?
Yes, I would. And it's... This is the part that I really like to listen to you on the most, because when you get into the history of the Jewish background, I mean, a lot of people, at least as far as I'm concerned, don't have a lot of that background. Now, granted, my co-host is shaking his head the whole time you're talking, because he knows the Jewish history, but
he knows certainly what's been handed down. I'll give you, Irving, I'm going to give you a story, all right? Here is the story of the Balfour Declaration that we were handed, that Chaim Weizmann, a chemist, had saved England during the First World War by finding a way to turn paint flakes into acetone and create bombs. And England was just so darn grateful for him discovering acetone that they gave him a state. Now, that's a story that's been handed down and for some reason not challenged. I went looking. Not a single bomb was created out of this magical formula. There was a factory put up in England. It didn't produce bombs. And besides which, have you ever heard of diplomacy like that? Loved your bombs. Have a state. This is what we're told, and this is what we bought. And I'm going to say it again. If I didn't stumble upon the Rabin assassination, and if only what I believed was going to happen, I believed in Israel, I believed that now the evidence was overwhelming, that they would reinvestigate, that they would try the murderers, and that democratic Israel would be preserved. That's what I thought when I did this book. And then I found out that the murderers aren't on trial. I was on trial. You never... Look, I don't want to tell you what I went through in Israel and why I'm in America. Okay? At first, they thought that they could shut me up just by slandering me. But I'm a very good speaker, and I have at least 400 speaking dates in Israel. I guess 395 were in Hebrew and maybe 5 in English. I went to every yeshiva. I went to community centers. Usually I was accepted very well, but when I hit the left, there were protests. And one day I was supposed to speak at Hebrew University of Jerusalem. The scholarly institute of Jerusalem invited me to speak, the Foreign Students Association, and this the government could not allow. And they put up a riot. It was all Secret Service. The students were not rioting. They sent a bunch of hoods in to riot against me. I was on the front page of Israel's newspapers for a week. I was the first item in the news. By trying to shut me up, they turned me into a celebrity. And a lot of people knew I was right. And when my book came out, it went to the top of the charts. And I'll tell you why. Because a member of the Knesset, Shimon Peres' buddy, his name is Ofer Pinas, that's really his name, by the way.
Oh, no.
He banned my book. He ordered my book banned from Israel, from the Knesset. He ordered all bookstores to ban my book. There was such an outrage that my book went to number one the next week and stayed in the top 10 for 3 more weeks. By the way, if you want a hit book, the only really big hit book I ever had, get it banned. I'm giving you a formula.
Okay.
Get it banned by a member of the Knesset or by the Senate, and you'll see a big hit book. That's what happened to me. So I was trying to make, and no fooling around about this, I love the Jewish people and I love Israel. Nobody seems to understand that when you protest, you have to also understand that half the country was being blamed for Rabin's murder. The religious and the right, especially the settlers, all were being blamed for Rabin's murder, and I found, without a doubt, they were completely innocent. Thoroughly, completely innocent. The guilty party was Rabin's own Labor Party, led by Shimon Peres. That's who killed him. The world was not as we were being told it was. And again, my book, Who Murdered Rabin, I think I gave it to you in Denver once.
Yeah, I believe so. You did.
Give it to Irvin.
Okay.
Just give it to him. Give it
okay.
to Irvin.
Okay.
All right, you start looking at the evidence. I didn't just write a bunch of speculation. People fed me the goods. People wanted Israel to be honest. You know, I ended up with 2,500 once top secret documents. I started with a few, and I've got stories. Boy, do I have stories about that Rabin book, which led, ultimately, I would never have investigated anything else if the Rabin assassination were reinvestigated because of my book. I wouldn't have investigated the rest of this, but I was fighting for my life.
Understood. Yeah. I remember the day.
I'm having trouble listening. Try it again. I'm listening.
I said I remember the day of the assassination. I remember it well. A friend of mine turned to me and said, "We're just like everybody else now."
No, we're not. We're not like everybody else at all. This was not a young kid who was angry at the prime minister. This was a coup from within his own party. And if that makes us like everyone else, which it doesn't, I guess we are like everyone else. Look, whatever your friend thought, it's based on the belief that a Jew killed Rabin. That's not what happened. All right? Rabin wanted out of the so-called peace process. He wanted out of Oslo. And, boy, what he did in the last month of his life to get Israel out of Oslo, it was forced on him. He saw that Arafat was thoroughly corrupt. He saw that Israel was going to be chopped up and destroyed. He tried to get out of this Oslo so-called peace process. And, well, I can give, why not? I mean, I could go on. Rabin travels to America September 23rd. He's at the United Nations for the 50th anniversary. And he tells everyone, "I'm from Jerusalem, and that town is not going to be divided." He said, "We may give the Palestinians sections of land that are not essential for our security, but we're not going to commit suicide." And he goes to Washington with Robert Dole. I've never, ever understood this. Robert Dole and him passed 2 laws in Congress. Now, I don't know if what kind of laws, if they're still on the books, that Congress voted in favor. One, if the PLO continues its terrorism, complete cutoff from the United States. No more aid. That's it. Two, Jerusalem remains united. The Congress of the United States, with the help of Rabin and Dole, voted on these. I believe it was September 24th of 1995. Try and find them. Rabin wanted out of Oslo. And Paris got permission. By the way, you don't just assassinate. He used the French Secret Service for all kinds of advice and all kinds, well, more than advice. The French Secret Service told him how to kill using the head of the Shabak, his name was Carmi Gilon, and how to plant a bodyguard to do the killing. His name was Yoram Rubin. And guess what? When Sharon died on January 3rd, well, it was two deaths. First, he had a stroke, then a cerebral hemorrhage. He had a little trouble with the first stroke. They didn't kill him well enough. It was the same bodyguard, Yoram Rubin. It was the same team that killed Sharon. And, look, killed Sharon. He's sitting in the hospital waiting for a brain transplant. All right? He's dead. It was the same team who knocked off Rabin that knocked off Sharon. And that led, of course, to, well, I could tell the story of Sharon as well, how they knocked him off. But it led directly to Paris becoming second in the Kadima Party, leading to his presidency, where the butcher is still president today. It's a very, very, if you're an Israeli ruler, boy, if I was an insurance agent, I would never give you insurance. Never. All right, now, you're going to have to pardon me about this. We have a hearing problem. Ask me again.
You can go ahead and get back to your plan.
All right, let's go back to the plan. I'm going
to
unchange it for you. Now, what I did an earlier interview, which, by the way, we have not done. I was planning, and I spent yesterday really, really gathering a good interview, but I like this way better. But I'm going to go back to one point. Now, I'm going to read an actual article from Yediot Achronot. It's the second biggest paper in Israel. Ami Meshulam, son of Rabbi Uzi Meshulam, is seeking political asylum in Canada and plans to sue Israel at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Now, what makes this important? Rabbi Uzi Meshulam was the rabbi who tried to bring the truth of the kidnapped Yemenite children to the Israeli people. Now, I'm not sure if either of you know what that is.
No.
No.
Okay. In the early 1950s, Israel did a terrible, terrible thing to the Sephardic children of the country. Now, the Yemenite children were kidnapped. Well, they were just taken from their classrooms. Their parents were told they're in a hospital, they caught a cold, and they were never heard from again. 4,500 of them disappeared. Worse, much worse, well, in terms of numbers. And again, these are Israelis who are waking up. 108,000 Sephardic children were taken from classrooms between 1950 and 1958. An entire generation of Sephardi children, they were taken to field clinics. Their heads were shaved. Little marker pens divided up their brain into 6-7 parts, and they were forced to take x-rays 350 times the permitted dose to human beings, were forced through the brains of every Sephardic children in Israel. The result was 6,000 dead immediately. The result was a people. The Sephardim have done very well worldwide, everywhere but Israel, where they were well, they grew up with their brains fried with gamma rays. Now, this is Ami Mesulam. I'm not going to go into the part two. There was a film called, it's called The Ringworm Children. The parents were told their children were being treated for scalpel ringworm, and that's why their heads were blasted. 108,000 Sephardic children were blasted.
Barry, now these are the children of the people that they initially set up Israel over.
What?
What are you talking about? When you're talking about, wasn't it the Sephardic?
They're from the Middle East. They're not.
Okay.
Sephardim and the Ashkenazi are two different groups.
Israel wasn't set up to bring in Sephardim. They were guinea pigs.
Oh, well, I'm sorry that I misunderstood something you said earlier. That's why I was asking again.
Israel was Ashkenazic.
Oh.
Israel's founders, Israel's establishment to this day is still 99% Ashkenazi.
Okay. All right.
All right. Now, the Ringworm Children won the Haifa Film Festival in 2003. I saw it on TV. It actually went on TV. You never saw a more stunned a group of panelists in your life. I phoned up the director, and I found out. I did interviewing on my own. You know, if you go to Israel and you see Moroccan women, most of the Sephardim of the 50s were from Morocco. 600,000 came to Israel, 400,000 went to France, where they did beautifully. You see women in their 50s, with men it doesn't matter, you can go bald, but women in their 50s don't have hair. They cover it up with henna. Their hair never grew back. And I always thought it was some sort of genetic problem with Moroccan women that they had very thin hair, and yet their daughters had beautiful, lush hair. I found out later that when you have 350 times the permitted dose of gamma rays forced through your hair doesn't grow later on. This biography was horrifying. Men in their 50s who couldn't walk, it's genetically passed from parents down to their children. What was done is simply ghastly. Now, I'm going to tell a story now that is contemporary. It's this week's story. It's about Uzi Mesulam, a rabbi who asked me to be the spokesman for his movement, and I accepted. Unfortunately, the movement was completely controlled by the Secret Services and a family called Shifrin, and he was in prison and couldn't do anything about it. I went and saw Uzi Mesulam in the far reaches of a dungeon called Sharon Prison in Israel, where he asked me, after I exposed Rabin, he told me, he said, no one's ever done that before. He said, no one has ever actually gotten through and done what you did with Rabin. I want you to be the spokesman for my movement. And he explained the worst of it. And by the way, I met Rabbi Mesulam previously, and he never asked me to be the spokesman. When they imprisoned him, that's when he knew that he lost control of his movement once he was in prison. Today he's a zombie. They lobotomized him. The man doesn't speak anymore. Now, this is a long, complicated story, so I'm going to just do the latest. Uzi Mesulam, and now I'm going to do a quote from the newspaper, from Yediot Ahronot. Uzi Mesulam led a campaign against the Israeli establishment, which demanded an investigation into the disappearance of 4,500 Yemenite children in the 1950s. All right. In May 1994, he entrenched his followers in his home in Yehud. During a police raid on the house, one of his followers was killed in a fire exchange. I was in the house. I was in the living room. I counted 62 bullets in the living room. There was no fire exchange. Paris sent the guns out. They sent the army out. They sent helicopters out to shut down this Yemenite, just like what happened to me with Rabin, but even far, far more serious. They sent the army in to shoot up Rabbi Meshulam, and they killed one of his followers. I went to the balcony where he was shot. His name was Shlomo. I counted 18 bullets. He didn't have a chance. Now we go to his son. Okay, let's just do the article. Meshulam was sentenced to 8 years in prison. After 5 years, his sentence was reduced by President Ezra Weitzman. He never continued his public campaign due to the fact that he was lobotomized. Ami Meshulam, again, he's the son who I met when he was 11 years old. Today he's got to be in his early 30s. We will claim that Israel is committing crimes against the people of Israel and a group within it. The Canadians, now remember, he's asking to be a refugee. And you don't become a refugee if you're from a country that's a democracy. He has to prove that Israel is not a democracy. Well, here's what he says, and then we'll go on to what happened. We will claim that Israel is committing crimes against the people and a group within it, the Yemenites, of course. The Canadians are interested in reviewing the evidence of the fact that, contrary to popular belief, Israel is not a democratic country. All right? He says that he was threatened by the Shabak, that they would kill him if he continued in his father's footsteps and tried to seek justice for those whose children were taken from their parents. Meshulam left Israel 4 years ago for Montreal, and he's now trying not to be sent back to Israel, where, believe me, he will be killed. And if I go back to Israel, believe me, I'm in trouble. And I want to go back to Israel. My children live there. My family lives there. I didn't come here voluntarily. I came here straight from a hospital where I was dead on a hospital table. I won't tell you what happened to me as well. We don't have time. It's just a very dangerous situation when you threaten the labor Zionists. And I repeat, not the Kibbutz Zionists and not the religious Zionists, just the labor Zionists. One out of three. Now, I continue on with the story. Thus far, six hearings were held during witnesses on behalf of Meshulam appeared, including a doctor who I interviewed, Dr. Shoshana Madmoni-Gerber, a specialist on ethnic discrimination. The man is desperately trying to get political asylum, and when he gets it, he's going to go to The Hague and sue Israel for kidnapping 4,500 young toddlers. Now, here is the punchline, and this is what Rabbi Meshulam told me in prison. He turned the radio on full blast so nobody could hear us. There was Haredi music, religious movement. I almost felt like dancing when he told me this, and later I found out that he was telling the truth. He said the children were shipped. I asked him, I said, look, if you know who the biological parents are, why don't you find a way just to unite them with their children? And he blasted the radio, and he said, because mostly the children are dead. He said they were shipped to America, where they died in atomic experiments. And then he explained the whole story that in the late 40s, nobody knew a lot about radiation, and the hydrogen bomb hadn't been developed yet, and they needed guinea pigs. And America used its own kids. They took them from school, just like in Israel. They were mostly black, or they were mostly retarded, whoever they felt was expendable. And then it got discovered, and the Americans got caught, and the Israelis gave them a whole generation of Sephardic children to do their radiation experiments on. Now we go back. The Yemenite children died in agony, in horrible atomic experiments, he told me, and I wrote about this, but then we have to understand why were the kids blasted with X-rays. 108,000 Sephardic children, the X-rays came from the United States Army. The machines, seven of them, came from the United States. Paris, Shimon Peres was chairman of the Israeli Atomic Energy Commission. He was cutting deals to use the Sephardic children as human guinea pigs. Now, I'm going to stop, and now I will push my books. Is that okay with you?
Okay, let me do one thing here first before you do that, and I'm going to say this is KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. Okay, go ahead, Barry.
Hi, this is Barry Travis of KHEN community-supported radio. No sense of humor?
Well, you're on it, so you're a part
now,
of it.
This was the time when I will say to your listeners, yeah, you want me to talk? I give a good talk. I'll tell you how to get a hold of me. First, the book you want about, well, my newest book is called The Compromised Land. But if you want to go backwards in time and talk about the Sephardic children and the Holocaust, you get my book, Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism and the Holocaust. It's available at www.lulu.com. That's lulu.com. There's a little search engine. You go into the search engine, you double-click books, and you spell my name. C-H-A-M-I-S-H. That's Chamish. And you'll get to my books. They're very to download is $5. To get sent to your house is $20. For $5, you can afford the book. Or for $20 if you're rich. My website is, well, BarryChamish.com. That simple. Barry, BarryChamish.com. And you will not get all my books, but you'll get plenty of material on my website. And if you want to phone me for my DVDs, including Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism, and the Holocaust, including Rabin, they're not on Lulu. You have to phone me. And invite me to speak, too, if you have a place. I give a very good lecture. My number is 904-315-8079. I repeat, 904-315-8079. There, that was the time to do that.
Okay, great. Right,
thank you very much. I'm very interested in you getting back to the division of Jerusalem with regard to the Vatican's role.
Let me finish up first, and then we will do that. That's how we will finish it off with the Vatican's role. Are you ready?
Yes, we are.
Now, once again, it's like magic that these things happen. But the biggest issue in Israel is that Deputy Foreign Minister Danny Ayalon had a press conference with the Turkish ambassador to Tel Aviv. They don't have an embassy in Jerusalem, of course. And he made him sit on a lower chair, and he sat on a higher chair. You know, if you've ever been to a shrink or a psychologist, they use this tacky trick where their chair is looking down on your chair. Humiliated him, and then went crazy because, now here it is, I will actually quote the article. Ayalon voiced anger at the envoy on Thursday over a Turkish soap opera. Well, in Turkey, the government run the TV station. Private TV is not a big deal there. Over a Turkish soap opera that spread a blood libel against Israel, claiming that the Israeli Secret Service Agency, the Shabak, their agents act as kidnappers of babies. Now, this is not something you fool around with in Israel. You can do all kinds of blood libels, all kinds of them, but the deputy foreign minister went crazy that the Shabak would kidnap babies, because that is precisely what was done to the new immigrants from the Middle East during the 1950s. And I have reports that says it went on all the way through the 60s as well. But nonetheless, Israel went bananas over this. Now, Turkey is becoming a major problem. I'm going to explain something about Sabbateanism and about who Sabbatai Zvi was. Sabbatai Zvi was a false messiah of the 17th century. He declared that he was the messiah of the Jews on June 18th of 1666, again suggesting very heavy Vatican influence. Those dates mean nothing in Judaism, but they, well, what other organization in the 17th century had the ability to make this Sabbatai Zvi the Messiah of the Jews to more than half the Jews in the world? More than, all the books say the same thing, and I always quote this, from Iran to Mexico, somehow the Jews believed that Sabbatai Zvi was their Messiah. Now, this is just rubbed out of the history books. Try and find, well, I got lucky in that a rabbi, Marvin Antleman, was my close friend, and for like 20 years he tried telling me that the leaders of Israel, the worst of the lot, are Sabbateans. And first of all, it took 20 years for me to absorb this and finally believe Rabbi Antleman. So how long is it going to take the rest of the Jews when I'm a known skeptic about history? They'll never find out. Never. Never. There's something wrong with the Jewish mentality. We do not accept different realities. If a new reality comes along that somehow opposes the one you were raised with, well, you're the most arrogant, egotistical person in the world. My reality is the only one that counts, and they cannot absorb this. And this is the downfall of the Jews, that they cannot believe that other Jews could really be manipulating and hurting them. And this is a message where I get in a lot of trouble, because the Jews say, well, he must be an anti-Semite. Right? Nobody could be more pro-Semite in the world than me. The anti-Semites are running, they're running Israel. They're running the show. This is the real problem. Now, again, Sabbatai Zvi, eventually the Turks forced him to convert to Islam, and most Jews abandoned him, but not all. A sect in Turkey called the Dogma sect decided that this was a message from Sabbatai Zvi that we also should join other religions and pretend we're amongst them, but at the end of the day, we will all meet and do our Sabbateanism nonsense. Now, I'm going to jump ahead before jumping back. This spread all over the place, but really underground. But not so underground as you may think. There was a second messiah in Europe. His name was Yaakov Frank, I'm sorry. When the interview is over, go look up the Frankist movement. It spread throughout Europe. It was enormously, enormously influential. They did the same thing. Jacob Frank decides that he's going to convert his group of Frankists. Well, they're called Frankists now. I assume they were called Frankists then. He converted 5,000 at one time to Catholicism. The bishop of his diocese let Frankism survive because he convinced them accurately. They were anti-Talmudic. The Sabbatai Zvi, the Sabbateans, believed that the Torah was correct in the opposite sense. In other words, do not kill became do kill. And they derived great energy from seeing a Jew who did not accept Sabbatai Zvi as the Messiah from dying. Rabbi Antleman's book, To Eliminate the Opiate, has a chapter called Burnt Offerings about what the labor Zionists were doing about the Jews in Europe. They were having fits of ecstasy. They were going to start the new Judaism their way. Now, as insane to believe that such a group exists, as opposed as it is to your reality, when the show ends, you look up Yaakov or Jacob Frank, and you look up Frankus, and you start looking at what was really going on in Judaism in Europe. And it was not what you think. Now, the Frankists, believe it or not, were no longer Jews. They were now pretend Catholics. They became spies. Because they were Catholic, they were now invited into the courts of Europe. There was banned Jews, and Yakov Frank had himself, well, a subterfuge company, but it went broke. He became dirt poor until the year 1786. Now, this is in all the books on Jacob Frank, and this is something, again, you should look up, because in 1786, he moved his court to Frankfurt, Germany, where suddenly he got rich. Now, just so you know, because this is very conspiratorial, even though, again, to expose a true conspiracy is to really do a mitzvah, a blessing, it's still going to be tough on people. In 1786, Frankfurt was the conspiracy capital of the world. Also in Frankfurt was Adam Weishaupt. Adam Weishaupt formed an organization called the Illuminati. Their basic goal was to infiltrate cultures that had abandoned Rome and get them back to Roman Catholicism. And they did a marvelous job. They're still at work today. Also, he was in Frankfurt. But so was Mayor Amschel Rothschild. Now, in 1786, he was not rich. He was getting wealthy. He had five sons who had a plot, an understanding of the world that went simply, if you control the economies of a nation, you control the whole nation. It's a concept that for some reason was never understood before this. What Mayor Amschel Rothschild had in his home were the two greatest conspirators of history. He had Weishaupt of the Illuminati, and he had Frank of, well, the Sabbateans. Now, their goal was to turn the Jews around, get them to stop believing in the Torah and start believing in the Torah as an evil book where the opposite was true.
Barry, before you go very far, I was reading something that you'd written about actually that the Rothschild's name was derived from another name, Close.
Irrelevant.
Okay.
Who cares what their name was derived from? It means Red Shield. It was on his house. Now, back we go to who founded Israel. Israel, if you look at their leadership, David Ben-Gurion, the first president, you know what, I have to even go through my own book. They all went through Russia. They all went through Turkey before they went to Israel. They called it in Hebrew, Lehit Aslem. It means to get Islamized. There was a massive movement of Jews from Europe through Turkey to Israel to found, after the Balfour Declaration, to found the Jewish Agency, but to found an Israel that was not going to be a religious Israel. When the Jews came in with their hair locks and their yarmulkes, they were greeted by the Sabbateans cutting off their hair locks and throwing their yarmulkes into the garbage cans. They were going to create a new Judaism with a new Messiah, a very false and a very evil Messiah. The Israel that was founded essentially in the 30s was an Israel without any obligation to the Jews. It had an obligation to something you've never heard about, Sabbateanism. There, I did the background. Now, shall we do the Vatican?
Yes.
All right. Is Irving there?
Right here.
I hear you like an itty bitty little hamster across the room.
I am right here.
Yes, I am.
I am right here.
I am right here. I caught it. Look, I caught Paris. I caught him dead to right with the Vatican. Now, here's how it went. In 1990, let's see, the Oslo Accords were, right, it was in, the original Oslo Accord negotiators did not include Shimon Peres. Rabin was afraid that he would sabotage the negotiations. Galen, who was actually Peres' deputy, was working with Rabin, and he didn't trust Peres either. The original Oslo negotiations began again with the Council on Foreign Relations and George Bush the father. On September 17th of 1992, Rabin was ordered by Bush to open negotiations with the PLO and prepare Israelis for painful sacrifices. And all the way until March, Peres, the negotiations began in November, where they sent a couple of clowns to Norway to deal with True Blue, the real thing, anti-Semite Norwegian negotiators, and with the PLO. Peres knew nothing about it. He discovered it in March, and he didn't think it was serious. In April, he got the idea that it was serious. And in May, he invited the Vatican to join the peace process, and he promised the Vatican half of Jerusalem. Now, I know you're taping, so I'm going to say goodbye to my other call. Hold on.
I thought it was us.
I'm on an interview right now. Give it half an hour. Bye. Sorry about that.
Okay, that's fine.
But you, we're on tape. That can be fixed, right?
Right.
All right. That's important. Don't let that go on. All right. Now, it's now May, and Peres sends someone named Mark Halter. His good friend Mark Halter, a French intellectual, he sends him to Rome with a letter from Peres, offering all of Eastern Jerusalem to the Vatican. All the Old City, all the holy sites. Now, how do we know this? Because Mark Halter had an interview with an Israeli newspaper called Shishi. The interview came out in after Rabin was murdered, I believe. When? It doesn't matter. It was in that same general area. Actually, I'll tell you when it was. Dates mean a lot to me. I want to get it straight. It was, in fact, the interview was, in fact, in March of 1994, March of 1995, because in September of 1995, the Italian magazine La Stampa not only confirmed what Shishi had written, that Peres offered the Vatican all of Jerusalem, they added details. What an agreement Peres had offered the Vatican. You're talking about that Eastern Jerusalem would all be a new Vatican state where it would be a duty-free shop. You could arrive in the airport without a passport. All goods, no goods would have duty on it. You would be arriving in the first international duty-free shop. Now, inside this enclave of cheap shopping and fun times under the Vatican's control, with, by the way, the United Nations policing it, that was also part of the La Stampa expose, the Vatican would give the PLO a capital within their enclave. And what else did La Stampa add that she missed? That Arafat agreed to this as part of the secret negotiations of Oslo, that's how we would get his capital when Peres handed over East Jerusalem to the Vatican. Now, you would think that this is the end of the story, but no, this story just had a tremendous, tremendous ending, because the next year, it was February of 1996, the radio station, it's now just a website. Arut Sheva once was a radio station I went on often, and I had hundreds of thousands of listeners. it was shut down by the government, and now it's an internet website. It doesn't have the power. But back then, there was now a leaker. Okay, there, he leaked to me. I promised I'd never give his name, but I found out that other people knew who he was, and I'm still not going to give his name because I keep promises. But he leaked documents to me that were astounding. He leaked. All I can say is he worked for a government ministry and had access to the different letters, cables, being sent from embassies worldwide to the Israeli Foreign Ministry. He had his finger on that pulse. What he found and released to Ruth Shaver was a letter from the Rome Embassy to the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Of course, Foreign Minister was Shimon Peres, promising exactly what I have just described, the handover of East Jerusalem to, and this is their word, the hegemony of the Vatican. And they produced it, and they showed it on their website. The next day, Haaretz, this was on their weekend edition, their Friday edition, which is a weekend in Israel, reproduced the cable on the front page of Haaretz, that the foreign ministry is planning to transfer hegemony of the Old City and East Jerusalem to the Vatican. The whole country saw this. Now, February was just before Passover, where Peres used to go to the tables of these big-shot rabbis and do a lot of politicking. They all canceled. Well, why shouldn't they cancel? I mean, this is the jerk that's going to give away our holy city to the Vatican. It's a good reason for canceling. So he had to come up with a statement to explain the cable away, and this is what he said, and there are still Israelis who believe it, I mean, who remember it, but nothing was made of it, and it should have been. He said that, yes, the cable is real, but some mischievous, pesky little person took some white Tippex whiteout and whited out the word not. And the actual cable read, Israel will not extend hegemony over the Old City of Jerusalem to the Vatican. And, I mean, that's a mighty urgent cable there. They must have been waiting for that for weeks to find out that Israel would not be handing hegemony of the Old City of Jerusalem to the Vatican. I mean, why just the Vatican? You could get a letter like that from any city. Supposedly, you're not going to give hegemony to anybody. It's your capital. Well, it turns out that Israelis bought it, and the rabbis re-invited him to their tables, and I have such a problem with Israeli and Jewish thinking. Who in their right mind will believe that phony excuse? But they did. And thus, you've got a situation in Israel where Peres is caught red-handed, handing the city of Jerusalem over to the Vatican. And nothing happens. Life goes on. Now, this is exactly what's about to happen in Israel. Because, again, Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be the one to divide Jerusalem. It's that simple. And you've got a situation in the country where Israel itself really is being isolated beyond anybody's capacity to understand. Turkey was Israel's friend. Turkey was the Islamic state that liked Israel. And to this day, the Israeli government's totally schizophrenic. This business about the Turkish ambassador and the low stool and the high stool, well, the good Jews, whoever is left of them, were trying to put Turkey in its place because Turkey has signed a military pact with Syria, recently held a joint military drill with the Syrian army, went to Iran and the Iranian leader Ahmadinejad thanked them for their fight against Zionism. They went to Lebanon and agreed to give them arms. Turkey is now lost to Israel. The labor Zionists, well, what can you say? Ehud Barak, head of the Labor Zionism, head defense minister, is going to Turkey for a good visit. His partner, Ben Eliezer of the Labor Party, thinks things are just peachy with Turkey. You've got pure schizophrenia going on in Israel. Pure schizophrenia. The Labor Zionists are thinking that this is our Sabbatean state. Nothing is wrong with Turkey. The Israelis have reached the point where Turkey is added to the mix. Israel has 120,000 missiles, many of them long-range, many from Syria with chemical and biological warheads, all pointed at the country now. And Israel has absolutely no defense against rockets, none. And even if they come up with something, nothing will stop 120,000. If you remember the war of 4 years ago, all of northern Israel was evacuated from 4,000 missiles over 34 days. No one was left in the north. Imagine 10,000 missiles a day hitting every part of the country. Israel is in a first-class mess of its own making. By the way, when I say Israel, I don't mean Israelis. But its own, well, how can we put this? Its own connivances, its own peace treaties, its own promises to its local terrorists of a state side by side in a divided Jerusalem and a divided Israel is going to ultimately see the end of Israel. And I wish I knew another solution where Israel could protect itself. But again, my main...
Barry, let me ask you, why would the Vatican allow this?
Allow what?
They have missiles pointing at where they just took possession of this land.
They want it. They think it's theirs. They think Jerusalem is their capital.
So they want it destroyed?
No, they don't. They want it.
Okay, I guess I just...
The Crusades never ended. The Vatican never... The Vatican had a kingdom of Jerusalem. Frederick, in 10,000, Second Crusade, the Vatican recaptured Jerusalem, put in their own Frederick Barbarossa, I think, whatever. The Vatican viewed Jerusalem as their capital. They viewed it as more important than Rome. Well, why would you ask why the Vatican wants Jerusalem? That's an easy one.
No, no. What I'm asking about, why would they allow them to point missiles at Jerusalem?
Who says they're pointed at Jerusalem?
Well, Israel, okay?
Israel is something else. Okay. Why would they? Because they want the Jews out of there.
Well, I would think that it would destroy them. That was my question.
It wouldn't destroy them. As long as Mount Zion and the holy places are kept intact, what does the Vatican care if Tel Aviv gets blown up?
Okay.
We'll go back again to what I'm saying. My strategy, and believe me, I don't have the effect I want to have, but my strategy remains the same. You got to get these labor Zionists exposed and out of the picture, and then you've got to get Jewish pride back where we stand up and we just threaten everyone in sight that if they touch Israel, what we will actually do. There's no other way.
Okay, and one other statement is I don't hear this differentiation between the different Zionists in the media that I listen to and any of the alternative media. We just hear Zionist.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ignorance out there. It's very frustrating. Look, I don't even answer the anti-Zionists. I mean, they find Israel responsible for anything and everything, and they back the Arabs totally and completely, and there's no reasoning with them, and I have nothing to do with them. There are gray areas that these people just don't understand. And again, I lived in Israel for 32 years, and I speak fluent Hebrew, although I may be losing it after all this time. But nonetheless, after 32 years and a long time in the army, I understand what's going on. They know nothing. And there's a major problem with that. People who don't have my experience and don't know Israel, I don't even read them. I don't even bother with them.
So you see the American left as being predominantly anti-Israel?
the American left is a problem because they view Israel somehow or another as the aggressor. And Israel is on the verge of being wiped out. And as for the Palestinians, we should never, ever, ever have brought the PLO back to Israel. Israel armed them and, well, created what's going to, peace is going to be the end of Israel. I'm telling you that right now. The PLO is just as dirty and corrupt and filthy as it ever was. I'm only talking about the Israeli side of things. There's not an Arab out there who actually talks about the absolute stupendous corruption in his world. And again, if you don't have an Arab actually talking about what's going on, you can view them as peace-loving, friendly people, and Israel is bad. Israel does have a free press, and it's people like me. Well, there are no people like me, but nonetheless.
So you are the free press?
There is a critical free press, and the Arabs don't have one. So it's the left just buy whatever nonsense. I ignore them. Believe me when I say this, there isn't a thinker in their lot that knows the score. And it's just very frustrating reading the hostility to Israel that's not based on what's really going on. Israel has got itself a ruling establishment that is just a nightmare to the Jews, not to the Arabs. And it's just almost impossible to tell people the settlers are probably the most honest people in the country, hands down. And all the crap you've been reading that they're oppressing Palestinians is absolutely stupid. The real score of the matter is the labor Zionists who run the country are oppressing Jews. And that's where I come from.
Well, go ahead with what you were getting into on the Vatican and that sort. I mean, when I interrupted you.
Oh, no, I just finished.
Oh, okay, all right, so you are done. All right.
Well, I wouldn't say done, but I think I got the main point in.
Okay.
Paris is a spy for the Vatican. Just outright, boy, is he a bad news president. Not only was he chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission when they were zapping children and toddlers in the 50s, he was behind the Rabin and Sharon assassinations, and he was caught red-handed turning over Jerusalem to the Vatican. Believe me, this is not a nice man.
So in 3 weeks, we're going to see this all come to the forefront.
If this report is right, probably within two to three weeks.
So, while we're at it, now, was this part of what we're going to talk about, a little bit about the water situation that was going on in Israel?
Yeah, why not? In the course of my work, I actually interviewed, way back in 1995, I interviewed the negotiator of the Jordan-Israel peace treaty, the water negotiator. It's a long story. I served in the army with his personal assistant, and he got me the interview. And I met him at a restaurant, and he started giving me the usual crap with the bar graphs, and I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to hear why Israel was negotiating water at all. It's a country that has its own water. What are you negotiating? And then I look at the graph of the Kinneret, Sea of Galilee. It's called the Kinneret. Bible thumpers call it the Sea of Galilee. No one else does in Israel. But nonetheless, the lake I see above a line, all kinds of green lines. And suddenly, below the line, I start seeing red lines. I said, why has the level dropped below to red? I said, what's going on here in this graph? And then he started telling me, he said, Israel is planning to give 50, 60 million cubic meters of water a year to Jordan. And he said, let's say you do that for 1 year. He said, you can recover from 1 year. He said, 2 years, you can recover from 2 years. It's like having a 2-year drought. But he says, forever? He says, the Kinneret is going to dry up. And he told me that. And then he orders a drink, and he starts getting very upset, really close to tears. And he says, I'm making dream water for them. I'm devising dream water. I'm producing water for the Jordanians that doesn't exist. And he started showing me what he was doing. We're going to dam the Yarmouk River and give it to the Jordanians. And he said, but that water was supposed to go in the Kinneret. He says, we're going to take some salt springs and divert it. And he said, there's not enough water there to make a difference. He said, I'm making up water. You can't just find water that doesn't exist. And he says, I hope our leaders know what they're doing, he tells me. He says, I hope they know what they're doing. He says, because if we give 55, by the way, the figure is 55 million cubic meters to the Jordanians. Later on, the Palestinians got another 30 million cubic meters. He says, if we give 55 million cubic meters every year, year after year, he said, that lake within 20 years is going to be dried up. And then I remember we left the restaurant. This was in Tel Aviv. The restaurant was Baked Sokolov. The man had had a few drinks. We walked to my car, and he says one last thing to me. He says, you can write anything you want. Don't use my name, which to this day I don't. And he says, don't write that I was the man who killed the Kinneret. I didn't do it. It wasn't me. And then he walked away. And, of course, everything he wrote is coming true in droves now. Right. The Kinneret is just drying up.
The JNF is running a large capital campaign right now, I understand, for reservoir building for the Negev project specifically.
Oh, the Dead Man Canal?
No, I recall having a meeting a couple of years ago with a JNF representative regarding some water initiatives for reservoir building. So I know that there's been active movement with regard to water resources.
There's been nothing whatsoever. They've been on strike all year. Nobody's building any reservoirs. They're not even looking at sewage treatment plants. The Israeli Water Authority has been on strike for the last 40 days in the middle of the rainy season. And again, don't kid yourself. This is a very dry region, and you don't make water where water doesn't exist. They're just, if the JNF said they're doing something, they're trying to raise money. That's all they're doing. It can't be done.
So there is no project to resettle the Negev?
The Negev? What's in the Negev? There are a few oases where they have taken rainwater and grown a few trees. The main water projects have been desalinization. And again, all that's done is made Israeli water incredibly expensive. This is just mismanagement. A new desalinization plant from Hadera went online a month ago, and the Israelis have to pay a 25% surtax on water because they're dumping the water into the main grid of the water system. They're using desalinated water to flush toilets, take showers, and irrigate fields. It makes no sense. Desalinated water should be used for drinking only. Everything is being done stupidly and wrongly and expensively, but more to the point, the water is being given away in so-called peace deals where the other side doesn't care one way or another. They're going to get Israel. They'll get a little water in the meantime. They'll complain that Israel is withholding their water, and while they're polluting their aquifers, they'll say that Israel is polluting their aquifers. This is a way of thinking. There is no gratitude for the fact that Israel is going to lose. It's only only major source of water. They're going to lose it by giving it away. Now, just so you know something, the Canary will turn into the Dead Sea when it reaches a certain point. The Canary is surrounded by salt springs. If the water drops below what is called a black line, the Canary is lost for good. Everything in it will die. It will become a salty soup, and it has been on that black line now for the last 3 years. It's winter now, so a little more water goes in. Come summer, back to the black line. Again, it was Israel's water. Why it even agreed to give Jordan or the Palestinians any water whatsoever makes no sense. It wasn't theirs to begin with. Jordan isn't on the Canaries. But these, when a country wants to kill itself in the name of peace, there's nothing, no act can go too far for that.
That doesn't have any kind of tie into the Agenda 21 water agreements, like the Law of the Sea treaties and that sort.
I don't know what that is.
Okay. So, do you see that there's any kind of resolve that's going to be done on the people's part, or is this just kind of a done deal?
All right. What's the done deal?
Of them just draining the water and that's it. You know, there's not much hope unless they've got some other kind of water resource. The people are either going to have to truck in their own water from somewhere else.
Well, luckily, Arabs are genetically camels, so they can go many, many days without drinking. How do I know the answer to this? But again, this is not Israel's problem. Look, there isn't... That country cannot support... two nations. It's absolutely impossible to support two nations. Bringing in the PLO was the so-called Oslo Peace Accord is going to be the ruin of both of them. If Israel goes, I assume that no Palestinian state is going to take over. The only option, theoretically, I suppose, is the Jordanians take over what was once Israel and it's back to Transjordan time. The whole thing is a mess.
What happens, an absolute mess. What happens to the Jewish people in Israel when
this
happens?
They'll be wiped out.
They'll be wiped out right in
front
of the world.
And I'm not saying that lightly. My children, my sister, my cousins, my whole family lives there. I'm not saying that lightly. It's heartbreaking. It's just heartbreaking. But if there's a rocket war... where 120,000 rockets aimed at every part of Israel breaks out, Israel, within a day or two, won't be able to defend itself. A new Holocaust will start, and what will happen is that the army will stop functioning, communications will break down, airports will stop, will be too pockmarked for jets to take off. The Arabs will come in looking for loot. They'll gather the men together. They'll gather the women together. They'll make the men, the husbands, the children watch as they rape their mothers, their sisters, and then they'll watch the mothers and sisters as they machine gun to death or slit the throats of the men. We're talking Holocaust.
What will be the reward to the labor Zionists watching all this?
Revenge.
The labor Zionists will witness this from where?
I can't hear you.
Where will the labor Zionists witness this event from? Where will they witness this instead of being part of it?
All right, you've got you start with a neighborhood, you start with a settlement, you overwhelm it. It's got no protection, it's got no army. You bring together the people and do with them as you want. That's what the Nazis did. That's what was done in Bosnia. I don't even understand this question. That is a Holocaust.
Yeah, but the labor Zionists that are planning this, that are looking at this as being a reliable future. Their reward is revenge. But where are they left? Are they left within the state of Israel, or are they outside of the state at this time?
Look, the people who matter, so-called matter, they've been, well, again, everyone in Israel knows this, that it lived at the beginning of Jerusalem. There's a massive tunnel where the government is going to function in case of a nuclear war, with a wonderful little road that you can actually see on the Jerusalem highway leading to Ben Gurion Airport. What you've got with the people in the know, they'll be fine. Everyone will be fine. Their money will be out of the country. Everything will go their way. It's, again, I hate to say this. My family is there, and they're not going to be fine. And I can't get them out. They're too Israeli. My children are proud Israelis. My nephew, my niece, they're proud Israelis. They won't leave. And if I go back, I don't know what's going to happen to me, but I think I may. I think we're coming to that, that in the near future, I'll just have to go and see what I can do.
Now, one other thing that you were talking about when we talked a little bit yesterday was something about the Yemen situation. Did you want to get into a little bit of that? Or
I think we did.
Okay,
if you mean
okay.
Yemenite children, I've already...
Okay, all right. Well, no, I thought you meant more the what was currently happening.
What I wrote about, again, were the labor Zionists with their little tricks. And you're talking about the so-called underwear bomber.
Well, that was one of them, too.
Well, no, I mean, Israel's got the Mossad have a serious presence in Yemen. Maybe you meant that. Just remember the underwear bomber along with the shoe bomber. They went through airports run by a security company called ICTF. It's a nasty little security company that when you want to up the anger against Arabs, and by the way, you've got enough anger against Arabs, but when you want to really up it, you almost down a plane over Detroit with a guy blowing up his underwear or starting his shoe on fire. That goes through ICTS. That's more dirty tricks.
Well, what's interesting is I was listening to one of your prior interviews with Dr. Stan Monteith, and this was before the underwear bomber, and you were tying in that same group in with 9/11.
Well, ICTS ran Logan and Newark airports. All the two airports were the planes, no matter what you believe about 9/11, whether there were planes, where the planes took off, the passengers arrived at Logan and Newark airports where they no longer, they disappeared. And again, that's two airports run by ICTS, founded by Menachem Atzmon, who sat in an Israeli prison for massive graft. He was the accountant for the Likud party along with Ehud Olmert in the late 80s. He was found guilty of tremendous corruption. When he got out of jail in 1999, somehow he was rewarded, given the CEO of a security company in charge of 22 airports worldwide. And you're right, the 9/11 planes went through ICTS airports.
Okay.
I don't want to dive into the. That's not something you just scratch the surface with.
Right, right.
But 9/11 is a very, very suspicious event, and it's not for me to dive into that in detail. But ICTS, I don't like it when the shoe bomber, the underwear bomber, and the 9/11 bombers all pass through ICTS airports. Don't like that. I don't like coincidences like that.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you wanted to cover?
You used me up. I'm sweating here.
Well, I appreciate you agreeing to come on and enlighten our audiences to a little bit of Israeli Jewish background here in history. And I want to thank...
Tell your people to get my DVDs. And get the DVDs, show this stuff. All right, I'm going to do this one last time. To get my books, go to www.lulu.com. There's a search box. You double-click books, and you spell my name. C-H-A-M-I-S-H. I recommend the last two books, The Compromise Land and Bye Bye Gaza, where I discuss how they got the Jews out of Gaza, more than discuss. But what we discussed today is Shabtai Tzvi, Labor Zionism, and the Holocaust. My website is www.barrychamish.com. And if you want to phone me for the DVDs or invite me to speak for any reason, good reason, the number is 904-315-8079. That's 904-315-8079. There, I got it out.
Thanks, Barry.
Thank you. And
thank you. That was really 2 hours. That was a good interview.
Well, and again, we thank you again. So.
All right. Don't forget, cut out the part where my other phone rang.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Good night.
Night, all. Bye.